I honestly have been really disturbed by the degree to which the empire framing has become more and more evident, because I wrote in my book that really the only parallel that didn't exist between the empires of old and empires of AI was the degree of violence that was being used back in the day versus in the present. And what's happened in the last year is now the empires of AI are supplying their technologies to the US military, and their technologies are being used to bomb Iran.
Welcome to Politics, a show where two software developers break the fourth wall and talk about the interlacing of technology and politics. I'm Josh.
And I'm Ray. We see technologies like crypto, AI, and surveillance infecting our politics. Meanwhile, governments and the media are making out that all this is inevitable. We can't leave the future in the hands of scheming technology leaders and their pet politicians.
We're here to raise our voice and open up the space for honest, good faith discussions. To help us organize and sharpen our ideas, we've invited some interesting and highly respected thinkers to share their understanding and their research with us and, of course, with you.
Politechs is where we smash the myths and get to the truth.
Ray, we need to talk about empire.
Let's see if we can get Karen Howe to talk about it.
As you know by now, my wish is your command. I reached out to Karen Howe, and she graciously agreed to come on and talk to us. So thank you, Karen, and hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So for our listeners who are not already familiar with you, first of all, shame on them. But second of all, would you mind introducing yourself?
Yeah, I am a journalist that has been covering AI for almost 8 years now for publications including MIT Technology Review, The Wall Street Journal, and The Atlantic. And I came out with a book last year called Empire of AI that is the inside story of OpenAI, but uses that story as a lens through which to explore the history of AI, the impacts in present day all across society, as well as this central question of how do we govern a really consequential technology.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, I think the Empire of AI book, I mean, for us, it's been one of the most important books in the whole recent history of AI, the recent LLM version of AI. So can you explain to us, like, why you choose Empire of AI? What makes the AI specifically an imperial technology, Karen?
Yeah, so I think first, I would say that I don't consider all AI to be an imperial technology, because AI refers to so many different types of technologies, but I am specifically critiquing the version of Silicon Valley's AI that they insist on developing, which is these really large-scale, energy-intensive, resource-intensive models that are contrived as what I call everything machines, meant to do anything and everything for supposedly anyone. And the reason why those are imperial technologies is because on the quest to building this everything machine, these companies are first laying claim to resources that are not their own. That's the data of individuals, the intellectual property of artists, writers, and creators without consent or compensation. Second, they're exploiting an extraordinary amount of labor, both the labor that they use to actually do the data cleaning and AI training of their models that never actually see a proportional amount of the economic value that they generate in return, but also in the way that this everything machine is designed to then be labor automating, so that when it's deployed into the world, it erodes away labor rights across different industries. Third, these companies control and censor an extraordinary amount of information. So at the most fundamental level, they are actually controlling and censoring the research that is produced about their technologies. So the public doesn't have a very good understanding of the true limitations and capabilities of the models. All the information, or most of the information that we receive, is filtered through the lens of what is ultimately going to abet the empire rather than undermine it. And this also extends to the way that the companies will present themselves to policymakers, for example, as the only true experts in what the technologies that they're actually building, because there are so few independent experts these days, based on the fact that the companies have bought up most of that expertise. And fourth and finally, these companies engage in this moral and existential narrative where they are the good empire on a civilizing mission to bring progress and modernity to all of humanity. And they have to be an empire in the first place because there are also evil empires out there in the world that are trying to damn humanity to hell. And so if the evil empire gets to the finish line first of building this artificial general intelligence or this kind of machine god, then it'll actually be a machine demon and everyone's going to die. But if the good empire gets there first, then it will truly be a god that brings us to a kind of utopic heaven-like state. And all four of these characteristics are not just true of these companies. They were the characteristics of the empires of old as well.
Yeah, fantastic. So it has been about a year since the original hardcover version of your book came out in the US. And by the time people are listening to this, the UK paper book would have just come out a couple of weeks ago, and the US paperback will be out imminently, within days, I would imagine. So people definitely can and should pick those up. I'm wondering, though, in the last about year, how has your thinking or your perspective shifted on this empire framing? Or maybe it hasn't, and you've just seen more kind of validation to your thesis.
Yeah, I honestly have been, I don't know if shocked is the right word, but really disturbed by the degree to which the empire framing has become more and more evident, because I wrote in my book that really the only parallel that didn't exist between the empires of old and empires of AI was the degree of violence that was being used back in the day versus in the present. And what's happened in the last year is now the empires of AI are supplying their technologies to the US military, and their technologies are being used to bomb Iran. And that degree of violence and expansionism is now, you know, I said that wasn't an existing parallel, and now it is. So I wrote most of the book before Trump was reelected, and then I finished the manuscript completely before he was re-inaugurated. And what we've essentially seen is, in since that has happened, is the Trump administration is really trying to, in every sense of the word, revitalize the United States empire. So now I see there's essentially two empires at play. There's the empires of AI and the United States empire that are each trying to use the other for their imperial expansion. And there is at once an allegiance between these empires because they're engaged in the same kind of domination project, but also this tense and fraught relationship where the ultimate goal of each one is to subsume the other. And so you see this playing out with, at first, the clash between Elon Musk and Trump, and then you saw with the clash between Dario Amodei and Trump.
Right.
But ultimately, empire is really the only way to understand what is actually going on. It's this kind of fusion between the desire to make a lot of money, like this capitalist drive, with also an ideological drive to expand to all corners of the world and consume all land, all resources, all information, and consolidate that into the hands of like the few.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like specifically they've been, although, I mean, you did mention the clash with Amadeo and Trump, but overall, the AI companies all seem to be merging with the Department of War. You know, there's been a small disagreement about whether or not the contracts they sign permit large-scale surveillance of the U.S. population or legal autonomous weapon systems. But these seem like fairly thin divides between the companies because, as far as I know, Anthropic don't say no, they just say not yet.
Exactly. Yeah, this is something that I think a pretty large part of the media and therefore the public actually misunderstood, was they thought that Anthropic was saying no, never. But Dario Amodei then went on CBS and gave an interview right after Anthropic was declared a supply chain risk, saying, actually, we think that autonomous weapons should be built, and we in fact offer to build them with the Department of War. It's just that this version of Claude is not ready yet. But yeah, you're right to say that there is very, very little difference between each of the companies and their position on the matter. They're all trying to fuse with the national security infrastructure of the country. And I think there are a couple reasons for this. One is that by continuing to make themselves highly useful to the US government, they also get access to things that are highly useful to them. Like the Trump administration has helped them get access to more deals and get them into halls of power faster. Mm-hmm. And, you know, before the US started bombing Iran, one of the biggest regions where the Trump administration was actually helping the company strike deals was the Middle East, because mm-hmm. the companies were running out of both land, energy, and dollars in the typical pools that they were seeking these things. And so they needed to go to other geographies and to tap into sovereign wealth funds in the Middle East to actually continue supporting what they do. But I think the other thing that people have raised is the AI industry is also, while it is extremely, it seems to be in a place of paramount strength, it is actually also really fragile underneath the surface. They have not been able to find a viable business model to recoup the massive amounts of investments that they have made. And by also integrating themselves into the national security apparatus, that increases the possibility of the US government bailing them out if and when the time comes. So yeah, all of them are engaged in the same exact strategy. Like, none of these companies are actually different when it comes to their desire to fuse fully.
Yeah, that's very interesting and also quite disheartening, to be honest. But one of the things that you go into in your book quite extensively is, as you said, the exploitation of labor and resources, especially in the global south. The majority of the rare earth metals, et cetera, that are being mined or are being mined in the global south. And also these labor pools that are being used for things like data labeling or making sure that the outputs of these models are not, well, awful in some ways. This is also happening in the global south. And all of us are living in global north countries. And I wonder what we can do to, you know, limit the exploitation of the global south through the things that we're demanding or the products that we're using, especially, of course, the modern AI stuff.
Yeah, there's two things that I want to mention. One is that since the publication of the book, the other thing that's happened in the last year is there more and more of this extraction and exploitation is also coming back, quote unquote, home to the land, like the heart of empire. So I've recently been reporting on the fact that data annotation jobs are the fourth fastest growing job in the US now.
Wow.
According to a LinkedIn report that was released early this year. Whereas I talk in the book about the extractivism that's happening, rare earth minerals and other types of resources being mined in Chile, we are also starting to see more and more data centers popping up in communities around the US and the UK, in rural communities and working class communities that are then also engaging in a type of extractivism as well, where they are sucking energy resources and water resources from these communities and pumping air pollution into these communities that ultimately are not the communities that are actually benefiting from this infrastructure being built. So that's kind of the first thing, is that this is kind of the logic of empire. Like, you extract and exploit and extract and exploit across the far reaches until you kind of run out, and then it starts coming closer and closer home. The second thing is, in terms of like what we still in positions of privilege in the global north can do, this is where we need to do everything that is within our capacity to constrain the empire and reimagine a different vision for AI development. Going back to this idea that there are many different types of AI, and that the critique that I lay out is just on this large scale mode of AI production. There are all of these other types of AI technologies that are much more efficient, much more specialized, require only a tiny amount of data, a tiny amount of computer chips, and yet enable a lot of benefit in areas like healthcare, education, and climate change mitigation. And so for people as consumers, you could think about shifting the ways that you use AI away from these large-scale models towards these much more specialized AI systems. But we don't just wear the consumer hat. We are also wearing a worker hat. We're also wearing a citizen hat. And what we've seen over the last year is also many people beginning to realize that they have a significant amount of agency in resisting the empire and the project that it's exacting by protesting data centers, by leveling lawsuits at these companies for copyright infringement or for the way that they're psychologically harming their children, by just engaging in extremely vocal pushback in community and online spaces, as well as to their policymakers, to call for actual sensible regulation of these companies. We're seeing more and more, you know, labor strikes happening to prevent the use of AI, adoption of AI in certain industries, as well as the exploitation of labor of the data annotators. And all of these are different actions that communities are taking, actually, not just in the US or the UK or the global north, but actually around the world, that are starting to have a really significant and severe effect on the AI industry's viability. Because as I mentioned, like, while they seem to have paramount strength, they are very vulnerable and weak at the foundations. And every act of protest, every act of resistance has been successfully chipping away at their ability to continue this imperial expansion. And so that's kind of how I see all of us playing a role in collectively shaping the trajectory of AI development, is both by engaging in these acts of resistance to bring down the empire, as well as investing in different alternative futures so that people can still access the benefits of AI without specifically enabling the production of a version of AI that is extremely costly to large swaths of society.
Maybe I'll jump in on that one, Karen. I know that Emily Bender and Alex Hanna have talked about AI through the lens of like automation technology. And I'm just wondering, when you mentioned that there is a specific imperial AI project, I'm kind of wondering if that extends also into the rhetorical, like they have kind of claimed the term AI for their own. And, you know, there are all of these technologies that are lumped under that umbrella. And I think, you know, sometimes when we start talking about benefits of AI technology, it's very hard to advocate for a specific technology and its deployment without somehow kind of co-signing the whole imperial project. So I'm just wondering, you know, if that sparks any thought in your mind.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I think that a huge part of what these companies do is engage in an enormous amount of misinformation by playing word games and never clarifying what they actually mean when they refer to AI, and always selling the benefits of certain types of AI that actually have literally no relation to what they're building. And therefore, like, yeah, mixing and matching, you know, the benefits of certain types of AI technologies with what they're actually engaged in. I wrote a story for The Atlantic, I think it was last year, that talked about how Microsoft specifically does this a lot when it comes to AI and climate.
Right.
So Microsoft engages in, you know, they were the biggest funder of OpenAI for a long time. So they are very much implicated in this imperial project. Mm. And the large scale resource consumption and data center construction and fossil fuel usage to power those data centers is single-handedly at this point reversing a lot of the climate gains that were made over the last decade. And there was this United Nations report showing that the four largest AI companies, Microsoft included, had increased their emissions, carbon emissions, by 150% from 2020 to 2025. And 2020 was also the year that they said that they would reduce their emissions to zero by the end of the decade. So, And all of it was because of the data center construction and the fossil fuels that they were burning to power that data center built out. But then Microsoft, because it has this reputation of being a very climate conscious company, just has put out report after report after report about how AI is so great for climate mitigation.
Yeah.
And like one of the organizations that I really love is called Climate Change AI. It's a nonprofit that does actually do really solid work on the intersection of how do you use AI to mitigate the climate crisis. But all of the AI technologies that they're talking about, the nonprofits talking about, are these really specialized tools that have nothing to do with what Microsoft is building. But Microsoft just puts out these reports where they don't actually say which version of AI. And I engaged in the most ridiculous back and forth with Microsoft comms people while I was writing this article, being like, can you provide me your best examples of specifically large language models or large-scale generative AI systems being used to help mitigate the climate crisis? And for, I want to say, like 6 weeks of exchanges, they kept giving me examples that had, once again, literally nothing to do with the large language models and generative AI. So like every time they gave me an example, I would be like, yet again, this is not what I asked for. Like, can you please give me like a large language model example? And they couldn't do it. And so, you know, after 6 weeks of exchanges, I was able to conclude in my piece that it just doesn't exist. Like, they just do not have an example that hits upon what they want the public to believe. Yeah. So it is a huge advantage to the companies that there is sort of a lack of nuance in the public conversation, the public discourse around the different types of AI technologies, and they can just fill that vacuum with kind of the propaganda that they want.
Right. So we need some new terms, basically, or new framing for these alternatives rather than using the same terminology, because, yeah, you've given them too many weapons, basically.
Yeah.
The other thing I was thinking about was there's been some, obviously, some like press, some news over the last week or two of, you know, attacks on Sam Altman's house, you know, the potential for violence in this situation has to, you know, around data centers themselves as well. I'm just wondering whether you feel like we're entering a neo-Luddite movement here where there will be like open revolt against this stuff.
I absolutely think that that is happening. Yeah. I mean, I think that this is kind of what happens with all empires. Like, at some point, the extraction and exploitation reaches a point where people are fed up. Mm-hmm. And when you have violently taken so much from them, they begin to also believe that perhaps violence is the only resort that they can also engage in to fight back. I don't in any way endorse that thinking. I don't think that, you know, the two attacks against Altman were in any way warranted. I don't think that people should be engaging in that kind of violence, but that is often what happens when people feel that they are so desperate from the degree of job automation that this technology has wrought, the degree of exacerbation of the affordability crisis that it has wrought, the degree of environmental and public health degradation that it has wrought, the psychological harm that it has wrought. I mean, like, many of these harms are intersecting on the same communities. And when those communities get to that level where you feel that you don't have the ability to live a dignified life or guarantee that your kids can live a dignified life anymore, like, yeah, it does start to engender violent thoughts. But I do think that, like, short of the violence, we also have seen some really remarkable non-violent protest that has actually been the primary characteristic of, I think, the resistance thus far with the protests and the litigation and people, like, peacefully coming out onto the streets and marching for their human rights in relation to the AI empire. So, yeah, I think there has been a huge rebirth of the spirit of Luddism in the modern day.
Speaking of kind of nonviolent protests against data centers, there's a great site, datacenterwatch.org, that kind of collects examples of data center projects that are being resisted and kind of keeps people updated on what's happening, how they can get involved. And there have actually been some success stories where, at the very least, they've had kind of planning permission, specifically in the U.S. are the stories that I'm thinking about, but where they've had planning permission at least kind of suspended temporarily for review. And of course, there have been others where, despite public outcry, they've just gone ahead with it, which I think is the worrying thing, right, that you were just speaking about. When people don't feel like they have any alternative, some people will then take matters into their own hands, which, you know, I'm sure we'd all like to avoid. But one of the things you mentioned there is the impacts on communities. And, you know, by and large, as you mentioned, it's these rural communities or historically marginalized communities where the kind of first impacts are. That's where they're trying to build the data centers. But now we're seeing energy costs going up. Like, even prior to the war in the Gulf, we were seeing energy prices going up due to the demand for electricity in places like Virginia, which, of course, I think has the highest per capita kind of data center population in the world, something like that. Do you see any signs that this is starting to drive people to action?
Yeah, I mean, I was meeting last month with a bunch of, I went to an event that had a bunch of data center activists across the US. And when I was talking with them, many of them were new to activism in general, new to politics in general. Data centers was their awakening. And it was because it's such a physical manifestation. It's such a close up look of the logic of this industry. It is literally coming to their towns. It is literally taking their resources. It is literally exacerbating the affordability crisis by hiking up their utility bills. And they also mentioned to me that this issue was actually, in some cases, driving conservatives to become liberals. Because it was a sudden realization from certain conservatives that this data center is something that the Trump administration is abetting and wants more of. And the extraction that is happening at the behest of these facilities is going to continue to happen and accelerate should they vote for Republicans again. And so, yeah, it has been a gateway issue, I think, for people to not just come to the larger AI empire conversation, but also to just this broader realization that democracy is under threat and their agency as individuals and as communities is deeply under threat. And it is driving many more people. I think it is going to drive many more people to the polls in the upcoming midterm elections in the US.
Interesting. Because one of the things that they're talking about with some of this technology is, you know, all this surveillance stuff. I wonder how much of this technology will be used in the elections themselves, because clearly the administration is quite happy to put out all kinds of AI-generated images and videos of its dear leader as Jesus in one case. You know, I'm wondering what you've, I mean, this is a bit of a small subject in many ways, but it feels like the AI is being used as a vanity project for the emperor himself. Mm-hmm. Is that something, do you want to talk about at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very true. The US government is using these tools in various ways to try and hold on to power within the Republican Party, both the engaging of like misinformation, AI generated misinformation and AI slop, but also like the use of it in the military. I mean, like the entire military operation, you could say, was a vanity project as well that is being part enabled by AI. And then, of course, the surveillance of Americans is certainly going to also be helped by these technologies to quash protests, to make it more difficult for Americans to exercise their right to vote. And so I think in many different ways, the corruption of the information ecosystem, the militarization, the erosion of privacy and human rights are all part of the general project to make it such that it becomes really, really difficult for Trump and his chosen successors to be ousted from power, I guess.
Well, Karen, we've been talking to you for a little while and want to be respectful of your time, but are there kind of any last things that you would like to leave our listeners with before we depart?
I think the most important thing to the work that I see ahead of us in terms of unraveling the empire is articulating a new vision of what we should do instead. Because I think in the absence of that vision, it's like, what are we ultimately fighting the empire for? Like, there's just going to be a vacuum of power that is filled by another power. And I try to get at that a little bit with talking about these alternative types of AI systems that can help mitigate climate change, that can help improve educational outcomes, improve healthcare outcomes. But I think that there's still more work to be done to create a bigger vision that can really rally people around this, like not just fighting against, but what you're fighting for. And yeah, I would encourage everyone that, you know, the audience of this podcast to really think deeply about what that vision should be, because the faster we can articulate that, the more momentum that there will be to ultimately hold these empires accountable and just build a better world.
Yeah. No, I think that's really important. And actually, we do have a conversation later in this season with Paris Marx, which is focused just on that question of what kind of alternative should we be trying to build. Karen, thank you again for your time. This conversation has been really valuable. I've appreciated it. I'm sure our listeners will enjoy it. So thank you for giving your time to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our absolute pleasure. Thank you very much. This is that bit at the end where we thank you for listening to this episode of Polytechs. First, we hope you enjoyed the show, and we really appreciate the time you have given to this subject. If you want to follow up with us, please send email to podcast@polytechs.dev, because that's very direct and doesn't have any algorithms. If you prefer social media, we're at Polytechs on Blue Sky, and at Polytechs at mastodon.social. We're not on Twitter for obvious reasons. To help the show reach a wider audience, please share it with your friends, family, and colleagues. There's nothing as good as a real human recommendation. You can find out more about the show on the website, which is polytechs.dev. As you should expect, there are no cookies or tracking of any kind. All the show notes, transcripts and contact details are over there. If you want to show a deeper level of commitment, there's also an option to donate. We're passionate about free and open access to the episodes, so there's no obligation and there are no benefits other than a warm feeling in your heart. Finally, we would really appreciate a 5-star review on your podcast platform. Reading positive reviews makes us feel good and can help others find the show and make them feel like it's worth their time. Okay, that's all the admin done, and we hope to see you next week. Bye!